Welcome to the Business Leader Spotlight Show.
I want to welcome everyone to the Business Leader Spotlight Show. This is Rich Spaulding, your host for today. And today we have with us Sohaila Azizi, a leading divorce attorney in Rancho Cucamonga, California. She's here today to talk with us about some of the legal issues you can encounter in a divorce. Sohaila, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. Sohaila, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your law firm?
Sure. I have started practicing law almost 20 years ago and moved from the area of civil litigation into doing more of the family law because of the attraction that it had for me, even though I avoided it for several years earlier in my practice. I feel that that's an area of the law that needs most amount of education for the public, and it gives me a special sense of satisfaction to see parties being presented with options that I give them at my law firm. You asked about my law firm as well. I'll give you a little bit of a background on that. I became an attorney because I was intimidated by attorneys. It was one of the scariest places to be at when I needed an attorney and I wasn't getting the satisfaction of having someone who would listen to my problem. So when I decided that I wanted to go to law school, which was a second career for me, I just decided that I want to be a person who people can relate to. I wanted to be someone that listens and that could offer solutions, a peacemaker, if you will. So that's who I am. My background, I was born and raised in Iran into a family that had my father from Russia. He was a migrant from Russia. And my mother was born in Iran. So the two of them met. We lived in Iran for the first 18 years of my life. And then we had to escape the country because of my community of religious believers being the target of persecution and execution when the new government took over. So I've had quite an interesting life with multicultural family members and then being exposed to a totally different culture, first in Europe and then moving to the United States. And I've made it interesting even more, beginning from my migration to this country. And I'm now an American citizen, and I enjoy the freedom here, and I try to give back to the community as a way of thanksgiving for all the blessings that I've received throughout my life, and especially in this country.
Okay, very good. Well, Sohaila, let me ask you this. In managing a client's expectations, what's the most frequent problem you encounter, and what should a person getting a divorce expect?
That's a very good question. Client's expectation, I would say, is one of the most difficult issues that an attorney must know and be equipped with ways to handle. Client's expectations in other areas of civil litigation are usually not realistic, and that's because people do not have a lot of legal education, even though more and more they're having access to websites and legal information. Generally, that's just a difficult area of life. And almost everyone needs the assistance of an attorney to decipher the codes and statutes. However, in a family law area, those expectations are much more difficult to be handled because emotions are extremely high. You deal with people who come in with frustrations, highest levels of anxiety, fear, fear of the unknown, and most often feelings of defeat and betrayal. People are not given education on what to expect when they enter into a union, and most certainly many people are not given information about how to deal with children and raising children with differences of opinion between the partners to a union. Those are the major causes of conflict. And when people come to an attorney's office looking for answers, they often feel that they have the answers. They just want the attorney to deliver those results to them. And that's one of the most difficult expectations that an attorney must know how to deal with. And I think knowing ahead of time that people's expectations should be handled gently and with a lot of care is what I have used as a tool in my practice. I listen to them and I create a solution for them. I do not necessarily deliver what they ask for, as often people do not know what they're asking for. And once they learn and they realize that there are solutions, it decreases their anxiety level, it decreases their anger and frustration level, and science has proven that people in stress do not necessarily make the best decisions. So an attorney's job goes beyond knowing the law. It has to deal with knowing psychology, having people skills, and just being able to listen and create and draft a solution for them that's suitable to that particular individual.
And do you find that your clients may have a false expectation of the time frame it takes to get a divorce?
Oh, absolutely. You touched upon a very sensitive point. They come in, they learn about an affair, they learned about something that creates urgency in their lives, and they want to file that divorce document and the other person that day if they could help it. So when you explain to them, and at least I do, I'm not sure if every attorney does handle that expectation of the client the way I do, when I explain to them that this process within California can take as short of a few months or as long as several years, they are surprised, shocked, but as I explain the process, as I draw a timeline, as I explain to them the disputes and the conflict and the level of anger and anxiety could delay and postpone this process unreasonably, and that they are in very much of a control in handling the time limitations and handling the delays, they are, you know, satisfied. They are pleasantly surprised to learn that it is within their control to reduce the amount of tension so that this process does not take years and years.
Very good. Well, what is the process one can expect when they go to a divorce attorney for their initial consultation?
Let me just explain to you that when people come in for free consultations that some attorneys advertise, it really does not involve their particular issues. My experience and understanding in this area is that the attorneys who offer free consultation are mostly they're offering that time to screen the individual, to make sure that there are no conflict in representation, to get to know the person and for the person to get to know them. So in about 15 to 20 minutes, that initial consult ends, and then a charge usually applies, and it could range anywhere from $50 to $100 to $400, and sometimes to a surprise amount. I'm an arbitrator for the State Bar of California, and a mandatory arbitration for fee disputes is part of my duties as an arbitrator. And what I see most often is the unmet expectations of the clients starting from the initial consult. The first dispute is that I went in, they had told me it's a free consult. Before I knew it, I got my retainer reduced by about $1,000 for that very first session. So again, talking about expectations, do people know what they get into when they go in for a free consult and then end up either frustrated leaving the office because they didn't get the information that they expected to get, or they sign a retainer believing that they are going to have the first session for free, whereas the first session turns into an actual consultation where the time is ticking and the billing has already started. So when they go for a consultation, I think all of these are viable questions to ask, even when the phone call is made to make the request for a consultation session, to ask specifically whether there is free consult, how many minutes or how much of a time frame does that free consult take, and then if I choose to retain after the first free consult, what are my obligations at that time, and if I choose to have another hour with the attorney just on a consultation basis, am I being charged for that even if I don't retain? So those are the questions to do at a consultation level. Now, when people call my office and they request that documents be reviewed. For example, someone has served documents on them and they want to know what their options are. My consultation will definitely go beyond the first 15 or 20 minutes of just checking the facts of the case, but also giving answers, which is a legal opinion. So for that reason, I will have to tell them that there would be possibly an additional charge for the additional time that it takes to review documents. Often they want to leave certain documents and have another consult with me to go over those documents with them and give them their options accordingly. So then that would be a different type of consultation. But what I always do, and my consultations are at $50 for half an hour, and I always tell them that if it turns into a long conversation, that I would notify them. And often it goes into an hour and nobody gets charged. But just so you know, asking questions and finding out what to offer the potential client as their solutions, with the variety of solutions and options that I offer at my office, it takes a good half an hour to an hour. And then I realize that people get overwhelmed with the information, and I have to cut it short and end it at an hour and let them go home, think about what was said, review their notes. I often encourage them to take notes and then to come back and continue if they wish, because it's just simply too much to absorb.
And that's excellent information. Now, you touched on some fees and some costs, but maybe we can elaborate on that a little more, because I know everyone wants to know the cost of a divorce. So what can they expect to pay, and who is expected to pay for the cost of a divorce?
Oh, God, you asked a question. That's a very wide range of an answer. It's almost like asking, how can I see Europe and how much would it cost me? It all depends on the manner with which people wish to travel this journey of getting into a litigation for divorce. As a mediator, I also do mediation and arbitration as part of my practice, and I often give those options to people and give it priority and preference and let them understand that there are ways to cut short the time, the expense, the anxiety, the fear, the stress of this litigation process. And in order to answer your question fully, I have to maybe base it on different options that I offer at my office. One of the options to a divorce, let's assume that there are a couple of children, a home, some real estate, some business, some other assets, 401ks, retirement pension plans. If you are to deal with those in a court of law in California, you file your petition, and in no less time than 6 months and a day from the date the court acquires jurisdiction over the other person or the property in the divorce, can a divorce be final? Sort of a cooling off period, if you call it that. People can get their affairs organized, their documents prepared, meet and confer, come to an agreement, resolve many of the custody and visitation and support issues out of court, and during that six-month process come to what we call a stipulated agreement or a stipulated judgment, and with the assistance of an attorney or a paralegal, finalize the divorce documents in exactly that time period, 6 months and a day from the date the court acquires jurisdiction. So that's a minimum time frame that I'm offering you, as well as a cost being at a minimum, because you could sign up in our office. One of the lowest retainer amounts that we have is a $3,500 retainer fee plus the filing fee of about $400 plus the cost of serving the other person. If it's not amicable, it would be costly. And serve the petition of divorce and the other person. It could be a petition for annulment. It could be a petition for legal separation. I'm not going into much detail on the types of divorce or separation that you have. But starting with the simplest, shortest in time, and least expensive in the amount of funds that you would have to have an outlay of cash or assets for, that is the best, the most amicable way of reaching a dissolution, finalizing the orders for custody and visitation of the children, deciding on the level of support, be it child support or spousal support or family support, and then possibly take a little bit longer to organize and finalize the affairs of the business. If there are pension plans or retirements, those will be handled by way of orders, but it might be years and years before the parties see the benefits of those retirement benefits. In a case of a 401k, there might be penalties for early withdrawals, so the parties are best dealing with those by orders, but not necessarily enforcing those orders or cashing in on their shares of those assets early on in the marriage, and could possibly postpone and address those issues later. In the economies that we've had for the last few years, many families choose to deal with the issue of sale of the realty at a later time. That is also possible. You could resolve amicably all other issues that could come to a resolution and be finalized through your court orders, and then leave the jurisdiction of the court present and available for a few either sticky issues or those issues that are not wise to be dealing with at the present time. Some people want to earn more equity on their home, and they want to come back and revisit the issues when the children age out of minority. Those are all possible ways of dealing with a divorce and dealing with the assets and properties of a marriage. That was just the shortest way. Now, if you can imagine every single one of those issues, child custody, child support, child visitation, spousal support, division of assets, and many other issues that there is not enough time to cover in this short interview, could drag on in courts for a number of months or years. And because the courts are given priority, or are giving priority and must give priority to issues such as domestic violence, such as custody of children, visitation schedules, those always come ahead of their agenda on their daily business, on their daily routine. So families who struggle with dividing up assets and properties, and they are hanging in the courts for a trial on that issue, they could be postponed several times, and that's another level of expectation that needs to be addressed when people come for initial consultation, is that it's out of the attorney's hand most of the time to determine and to speculate as to the number of months it takes to resolve or bring to trial an issue over a sale of real estate. Again, if they want to resolve those issues out of court, there are other options available, such as mediation, such as private arbitrations, and they could choose to determine their own time frame. Again, give 6 or 8 months for discovery and investigation of assets and resources that are available to both parties, bring it to the table, get the help of a mediator to facilitate the process, or possibly hold the parties' hands, and then retain the services of a paralegal or a law firm to just finalize the documentation, you could be in and out of this process within the 6 months to a few months, you know, more or less of a process.
Great info. So let me summarize very quickly for our listeners. Sounds like to me what I'm hearing from you is that if both parties can come to a resolution, they can agree on things very quickly, maybe they don't have children or even any assets or real estate, they can expect that their fees for the divorce could be fairly low or on the lower end of the spectrum, but there is a time frame in the state of California of 6 months and 1 day. So they should expect that. Now, if the parties cannot come to any type of resolution or agreement quickly, there's disputes over assets, disputes over custody, and there's businesses to go through the information, maybe even do discovery processes for other assets, the fees can just go on and on and on in the costs.
Yes, and the cost could be expected at the rate of $300, $400, $500 an hour, depending on what the attorney charges and what the staff at the attorney's office charge to work up a case and prepare it for the end of the line, which would be a trial on all the issues of the divorce. And if you can imagine being in court for half a day of just a simple hearing, it's not even a trial of the matter, but a few hearing that will take you all the way up to the time of trial, if an attorney has to spend half a day and send you a bill for $1,500 for being in court for a few hours while waiting for other cases to be called, not to mention the attorney's preparation time and preparation of documents to be filed in that short hearing of a half a day, is another few hours, again another $1,000 or $1,500. Every time you dispute an issue and you expect your attorney to be preparing documents and finalize it in court by way of bringing it in front of a judge, you've taken care of a $3,000, you know, retainer or additional cost to an initial retainer of usually $5,000 or $6,000. And you have to expect that money is gone when the attorney comes back and tells you that after several hours of waiting, the judge either ran out of time or other matters given priority took precedent over your matter, and now you have to come back to court maybe in about 2.5 to 3 months, because the next session is not the next day. Next session is the next available court date, which often takes somewhere around 2 to 3 months to happen. So the cost of something, with the business affairs to be dealt with experts. You have forensic expert on every issue. You could bring them in on custody evaluations, costing anywhere from $3,500 to $5,000 to $7,000. Those are extra, not going to the attorney's office, but going directly to the expert's office. You could have forensic accounting of no less than $4,000 or $5,000 initial retainer, and costing in the areas of $50,000 to $60,000 for multi-business family, and dividing those up and finding cash flow analysis. Anything that you can think of could be at a cost of at least $300 to $400 an hour, plus the cost of the forensics and the experts in the field.
Okay, very good. Well, let me ask you this. When you have a non-working spouse, say they were a homemaker for a decade, decade and a half, and they file for divorce against a working spouse, how does that affect the non-working spouse?
Tremendously. The standard of living that the parties have maintained during the marriage has a lot to do with the termination of support for the party who seeks the support and for the party who is obligated to pay the support. The court's policies are to maintain as much of the living style that the parties maintain during their marriage as possible, to compare it to the standard that they have to maintain after separation. That policy alone creates a conflict, because everyone knows that half of an apple is not the same as a full apple, correct? Therefore, when the judges try to make this family, which is now split into two households, to be maintained at the same level of expenses that it was taking place during the marriage, it's almost an impossible task for any judge or person to do. So the starting premise of making sure that these parties after separation can maintain the same lifestyle is not realistic. However, it's also not realistic to expect a party to the divorce who has maintained a house job or a caretaker for the children or a homemaker with no work experience to all of a sudden be out there looking for an employment that will pay him or her enough money to maintain the same standard of living that they've maintained before. So it creates a situation where anxiety is up, frustration is extreme, and the person who's obligated to pay support cannot understand how those numbers will work, because they have to maintain another household, all separate from the other person for whom they're paying support. Most often, having the children 100% during marriage is now going to change. Both parties will have to maintain a kind of household that accommodates the children and the upbringing of the children. Therefore, the cost of maintaining a home that has two sets of everything, sports gears, homeworks, school projects, these all create a situation where the expenses of being divorced is almost unbearable for the parties, let alone bringing in the expenses of having to retain counsel. Now, if there is counsel on one side, of course, the other person would be tempted to have counsel as well. And then with the cost that we estimated somewhere around $5,000 to $10,000 for initial retainer for each party, in case of having real estate and property and businesses and costing somewhere from $50,000 to $60,000 to hundreds of thousands of dollars, could be very frustrating for the person who is now ordered to take all the burden of paying for the expenses of a divorce. So, of course, the person who works will have a bigger burden to carry, because that person has proven over the course of the years to be the breadwinner, and the other person has proven to have either no skills or skills that have been outdated over the course of marriage, having stayed home and either promoted the other person to make a better employment life for themselves, or in any way contributing to the other person to bring the earning capacities to this family. So now this other person will have to get some help from the person who was working during the marriage. And the courts do look at that. A lot of times the courts will expect the person with high level of education who for some reason had chosen to stay home and not work to eventually become self-supporting. And it is actually part of California statute to obligate the parties to learn skills and to have their efforts be geared towards becoming self-supporting in a matter of time. Now, that matter of time is a very interesting question, worthy of volumes of case law to be discussed outside the scope of this conversation. However, persons after a separation and divorce are expected, in the eyes of the law, to become self-supporting, either by educating themselves or finding skills that might take a few years to equip them to become self-supporting, or it has to come from reliance on the person who always provided that kind of support to them. So after separation, the courts are very aware of the difficulties of managing two households, yet they would have to make sure that the person who left the household or who is left without the skills or education to be supported for a while until they can get on their feet.
Very good. Now, it most definitely sounds like both parties' lifestyles, including the children's lifestyle, are going to change dramatically after the divorce.
Absolutely. And this is another expectation that needs to be dealt with early on when the client comes in for a consultation.
Okay, and that leads me to my next question, and that's how is the custody of the children determined in the state of California?
California mandates that the parties go through a process when there are children involved that will that is consisting of counselors who would interview the parties and would help them determine some kind of a schedule that would maximize the best interests of the children. The standards are multifactorial, and they would have to do with which parent, if not both equally, because that's the premise we would like to start with, that both parents are capable and equally competent to take care of the children. So you would hear this percentage of a 50-50 parentingor equal parenting or equal timeshare be thrown around the family courts. But that's the ideal scenario where children and parents could spend as much time in a continuous and frequent and ongoing basis with their children, so that the children will not be affected, but at least they will be affected with least amount of torment and trauma and distress going through this process of dissolution. Now, if there are counselors involved who have been dealing with the children, their assistance becomes very helpful to the court or to the family counseling session that the court mandates the parties to go through. And their recommendations will be helpful when the judge hears the matter for the custody and visitation issues to see what those family counselors have thought about this family and what kind of a timeshare is the best for this family. I say that, however, I try to discourage families to leave it up to the stranger, either in the family court office or in the court, to decide what's best for their children. I often encourage them to come up with a plan, with a schedule that works for them. And if they do have a stipulated order regarding custody and visitation, again, that's another way to avoid the long, dragged-on process of litigation over what's very sensitive to the families, which is the best interest of their children. If they are worried about their children going through this process, they must not allow the court to interfere with their well-being.
Okay, so in California, they basically are looking out for the best interests of the children, and they prefer that the parties work out their parenting among each other versus forcing the court to decide for them.
Absolutely. But if they come to court, the court automatically schedules them to be seen by a family counselor who could help them throughout this process. And either during that process, they reach an agreement, they either sign their agreement, and that takes care of that issue, or they reach a temporary agreement, and then they will allow the court to address that at a trial or at a later time. But again, the parties who can go to court with an agreement, at least on the children's issues, they are the wisest ones.
Okay, good advice. Now, if there's domestic violence in the marriage, what steps would you generally recommend someone take as they prepare for getting a divorce?
Okay. Many people hear, and they believe this to be true, that domestic violence would be helpful in the divorce process because it gives the person who's the victim of the violence an upper hand on the issues of custody and visitation and often in the support issues. The way I give consultation to people is not generic advice to tell them what to do to make the best, scenario for their divorce. What I do often is to try to see if people are in the divorce consultation for the right reasons. I'm not trying to talk people out of divorce, but if they are getting divorced for the wrong reasons, I certainly would not want to be the attorney who would sign their paperwork for them. If they choose to go through the divorce process, I screen for violence. A lot of times domestic violence is subtle and it doesn't come out to surface as bluntly as one would expect it to. So it's a long process of getting the trust of the individual to the point that they would actually speak about the domestic violence. Now, there are scenarios where domestic violence has been the prevailing theme throughout the marriage, and there are many incident reports from the police involvement, interference, and the law enforcement having had to deal with that issue. And for your listeners, I would hope that they would know that the process of a criminal proceeding is very different than the process of a family law proceeding. There are different courts for those purposes. Now, if the law enforcement is called and certain reports have been prepared, or possibly certain arrest and conviction is on the record, those are definitely serious factors to be taken into consideration for a court in family law who is deciding on the issues of custody and visitation or support, for example. If a father who beats up on the children and the mother during the marriage, and there is documentation of that domestic violence and abuse, that is definitely of upper concern and utmost concern to the court. And of course, in my consultations, that issue comes up very seriously, and recommendations are to address them either through the law enforcement agencies as soon as possible, or through the family law court, which gets the parties before a judge, at least for the protection of themselves and the children, with temporary orders until some actual trial could be held on that issue. And those proceedings are done separately than the family law proceeding. The time delays that we talked about in the family court, the exception to those, one of those exceptions are the domestic violence cases. Those take priority and they are addressed and taken to trial immediately. However, if there's a criminal proceeding open at the same time, there might not be a possibility of having testimony in a family court where there is still a pending criminal case where the Fifth Amendment is taken by the offender. You see how that could drag on a case that could otherwise be handled in a family setting. In a matter of less than a month, with orders and protective orders issued from the court, restraining orders to protect the individuals from the offender, whereas if that person is in a criminal court, there are other types of restrictions and restraining orders from his contact or her contact from the family members, and those may have to be just in a limbo for as long as the family law orders may have to be in a limbo for as long as the criminal case has not proceeded to trial. They're really different systems that are in place, and a lot of times family law cases have overlaps and interaction with many other courts that we have. The business affairs of a couple could take them into a civil court. A tort, for example, some kind of a battery within the family setting could take a person into a criminal court as well as a civil court for recovery of damages, or a bankruptcy within a family business could take the parties into a bankruptcy court. So it's a very interesting area of the law, very sensitive area of the law, many overlaps and interaction with other areas of the law, yet we see that 80% or more of individuals are not represented, and they come to court in what's called in pro per, representing themselves. But I seriously advise your listeners or whoever that I come across to at least get a consultation from an attorney who is very much of an expert in a family law area to give them their options and weigh their options for them.
Okay, very, very good information. So, Hala, we've reached the end of our radio show, but if I may, can I ask you just one quick question, one more?
Yes.
Yeah, and it really is, you know, if our listeners are looking for a divorce attorney, you know, what should they look for and how should they go about selecting the right attorney to represent them?
Okay, well, thankfully these days there are all kinds of research and resources available to individuals. They can be on the internet looking at the person's website, reading about them, finding out, you know, on the blogs. I don't necessarily give much credit to some of the blogs only because a disgruntled client or the opposing party could be the source of that comment. However, an initial consult with a few attorneys to see which ones you are most comfortable with is a very good way to go. But even to get to the point of selecting those few, I would say to either call your local county bar associations, talk to staff in the courtrooms. They will tell you which attorneys are good, which attorneys are, you know, kind to client, which attorneys are nasty, which attorneys are aggressive, which attorneys are just trying to drag cases out. There's a lot of hearsay information available in the courtrooms. Or I would just say go in and sit in a family court for half a day. Just try, you know, just a couple of hours in each courtroom. There are usually a few courthouses that will allow you to just go in and sit in and watch. It's a very interesting, eye-opening, and educational experience. And maybe you'll see a few attorneys that you would like to set up an appointment with and have a consultation.
Great. Very good. Well, Sohaila, I want to thank you for sharing your insights with us today. It's truly been enlightening.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoy educating the public in this area. They do need to be educated, and I hope they attend as many workshops that they're available to them through the courthouses. There's some resource centers that would help people and hold their hands. So they should do their investigations before they enter and step into this path, as opposed to having regrets and trying to fix the problem afterwards.
Okay. If our listeners want to learn more about Sohaila Azizi, you can go to her website at www.azizilaw.com, and that's AZIZILaw.com, or you can just call her office at 909-484-9992. Again, Sohaila, thank you for being on our show.
Well, thank you very much, Rich. I enjoyed being on your show.
Thank you for listening to the Business Leader Spotlight Show.